This podcast is presented to you by a new series, the Clergy Confessions Podcast, now available wherever you get your podcast. Listen to ministers share truly awful experiences in anonymity. In this first season, you will hear stories of a minister fighting for maternity leave deep into her pregnancy, a pastor being fired for discovering an embezzlement scheme by the deacon board, an associate pastor finding his senior pastor and office administrator having an affair on church property, and so much more. Visit clergyconfessions.com. Follow Clergy Confessions on Instagram, Facebook, and whatever Twitter's called now.
You know, one of the empires you write a great deal about is healthcare system. America's healthcare system is more tyrannical than capitalistic. You know, in fact, that costs are astronomical. The people dealing with medical debt, you know, that's an unfathomable number of people, leading many people to avoid care or not trust the system altogether. You know, we're not here to fix the healthcare system in this interview, but we can talk about why this is a theological matter.
Welcome to the CBF Podcast Conversation. We know that conversations matter, so each week we are grinding through the critical research to bring you the best stories and resources of people doing groundbreaking and innovative work in renewing God's world. I'm Andy Hale, your podcast host. This year, we are starting our ninth year of the podcast, bringing you even better interviews worth your time, attention, and collaboration. These episodes are not intended for you to listen to in an island unto yourself. Get online and share your insights, thoughts, and feedback from the podcast on CBF's X, Facebook, and Instagram pages. We also want you to join the CBF podcast community through the CBF podcast listener support page at cbf.net/podcast support. We want to give a special shout out for some of our listener supporters, including the Honorable Charles Qualls, Caroline Bell, Cindy Foldenlohr, Trip Hawthorne, Bill Johnson, Carson Fushi, Ralph Stocks, and then a generous anonymous donor that keeps giving in honor of CBF Grump. Thanks for listening, Apex, North Carolina, Anderson, South Carolina, Garland, Texas, Montreal, Canada, Jacksonville, Florida, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Johannesburg, South Africa. First-time listeners or long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. And before we move on, we want to give a word of gratitude to our annual sponsors, including Zondervan Media Company, A Model Ministry, Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky, and Baylor's Garland School of Social Work. We need to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity. The Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity aims to equip, nurture, encourage, and support men and women for their best service in the kingdom of God. Offering several programs, including master's and doctoral levels, you'll be equipped and encouraged to discover the unique place where your faith reaches out to meet the needs of the world. Now enrolling for fall of 2023, for more information about Gardner-Webb Divinity programs, scholarships, and grants, call 704-406-3205 and visit gardner-webb.edu. Our guest for this week's CBF podcast conversation is Lindsay Medford. Lindsay is a writer with her work appearing in Sojourners, Deconstructionist Playbook, and more. She's the author of several books, including My Body and Other Crumbling Empires. She's also the host of the Crumbling Empires podcast. Lindsay, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy.
So before we get into the book and your personal story that surrounds it, tell our readers what you what you want us to know about you.
Oh, well, I grew up evangelical here in the South, in the suburbs of Atlanta, and I went to did a little of the traveling you feel compelled to do as a young 20-something, and lived in Syracuse, New York, and Boston, Massachusetts, and Charleston, South Carolina. But now I'm back in East Tennessee, and this is kind of my home landscape here. So I did in Boston, I did my master's in theological studies, and I was on the academic track of life before I got sick. But now I am a writer and a I live with my husband and my dog here. We're back in my home landscape in Tennessee, and we are expecting our first kid in 1 month from recording. So we're really excited about that and reorienting our lives around that right now.
Full disclosure to our audience, I actually was asking if we could do a live interview whenever kind of the contractions hit. I felt like that would be the best way for us to do this, but you for some reason declined that. So, yeah.
You know, well, sometimes I think I know about living with pain, but that would be a real test.
Well, because your book isn't necessarily related to this, but something that you kind of a moniker that you, you know, kind of add to describing who you are as being, you know, post-evangelical. And certainly our audience will resonate with that because a lot of the guests, the theologians and authors and various folks we have on here are post-evangelical. You know, for a lot of people that it became a term in which kind of we were fleeing from this thing, deconstructing this thing and potentially reconstructing something else. So I always like to ask folks who identify in that way, and myself included, kind of what you feel like is your new kind of faith identity as a post-evangelical?
I love this question. Because I'm perfectly fine with that label, but when the first thing that comes to mind in answer to your question is that I also really feel like a super pre-evangelical. I was lucky enough to start out my theological education with a strong background in historical theology, and to join some liturgical congregations and learn from some Catholic and Orthodox mentors during that time. And so so much of my deconstruction, etc., as you might put it, has felt less terrifying because what was always touted to me as traditional, I quickly learned is only I don't know, you know, when they put those timelines of the universe and they're like, humans are in the last 1 second of the universe. Whatever, you know, evangelicalism is kind of like that in the broad timeline of Christianity. So anyway, I have found a pretty comfortable home in the Episcopal denomination and grounding in liturgy and in the Eucharist, and identify a lot with the Christian mystics over time, and I do always come back to my evangelical love of the Bible, however complicated that may be as well.
So you have a new book, My Body and Other Crumbling Empires. This book examines the sickness of our world, the environment, and the people who inhabit it. You wrote over and over, my body with this disease has drawn me together with others. My illness is usually invisible, but since I started sharing about it with others instead of hiding, I've discovered I'm surrounded by people who also live with invisible physical and mental illness. This book is grounded in your lifelong experience with sickness. Walk us through your journey.
Yeah, I was first diagnosed with the rare autoimmune vasculitis that I have called Behçet syndrome when I was a kid, probably 8 or 9 or 10. And that in retrospect, as I was writing this book, I realized how much that it did affect my life as a kid. But I, you know, sometime around adolescence, it went into remission, and my adolescence and early adulthood was not as formed by that experience of suffering, of being out of school, of trying to avoid pain that had marked my childhood somewhat. And so when my disease came back at the age of 26, I was totally blindsided. I had known that this was possible and perhaps even probable. But I didn't think about it because I was 26 and I had things to do. And what are you going to do? How are you going to prepare for autoimmune disease to wreck your life? I don't know. So at age 26, this became a whole journey of learning to be chronically ill. And it took me a good several months to a year to start there. You know, like, chronic illness is chronic and it doesn't just disappear in the way that I had kind of expected to walk into a doctor's office and they would say, in the 10 or 15 years since you dealt with this, we found the miracle cure. It's this pill, and you're going to take it every day and never think about your body again. And instead, the treatments that were most readily available did nothing to do damage. And so the book is the story of starting to sift through what it means to live with a body in the midst of systems that we can participate in but not control, that offer us signals that we may not like, particularly in terms of pain, that systems and bodies that have something to say to us about who we are called to be and about the world around us and about our lives, that we have to accept and cooperate with in order to carry on. And that journey also drew from my experience of depression. And I've had so many conversations, particularly since the book came out, about how readily a chronic illness experience maps onto a mental illness experience as well. So that's the condensed version of my life with illness.
We can't go any further without telling about one of our annual sponsors, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. How does your congregation handle ministry staff leadership for areas such as youth and children's ministry? More and more churches are cultivating these leaders from within their congregations. Going away to seminary is not an option for these persons, yet many desire some level of theological education to better prepare them for their ministry role. In response to this trend, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky has launched the Homegrown Initiative. The Homegrown Initiative offers ministry leaders options for training and growth that fits into their busy schedules. If you or someone else at your church is serving as a homegrown minister and is looking to be better equipped as a minister, visit bsk.edu to learn more about new creative options for growth. bsk.edu. That's bsk.edu. One of the things I love most about the book is that you're not afraid to be transparent. You give readers a glimpse into the emotional and psychological experience of chronic illness. You wrote, having a chronic illness, like any suffering in this culture, really feels isolating and scary. Sick people end up feeling self-conscious. We're told we're unusual or failures or seem like a downer or an embarrassment or weakness that we should never show. You know, I'm thinking through the way that language has been nuanced in the last couple of years, especially around some of these things. Do you feel like, culturally, America's culture is one thing, but then the congregational church culture around these things has shifted any in the last couple of years to be more accommodating and caring and empathetic towards those that face chronic illness?
It's hard to tell. Whenever you get in, like, publicly into a conversation, then that becomes your world a little more than everyone else, right? And so there's definitely, I'm really excited about all the people I've met who are talking about this and all the resources available for changing how we think about this and how we act around this and how we care for each other. I do think there is, like with so many things, there's a difference between learning the right language and then shifting the cultures that are formed by that language. And I'm excited to see where, how we're gonna continue to learn that piece, that like slightly deeper piece of how we organize ourselves and how we meet various moments and challenges in a way that runs counter to the ways that capitalism and white supremacy are so ingrained in us that we are moving our default from productivity to community and care and really valuing those things. So yeah, I think there's I definitely see what you're saying for sure. It's been a great gift of writing this book to get to be in those conversations and see where people are doing really good work and, you know, on a large scale and even on a small scale in themselves, getting to talk to people who just say, just in their own lives, like, I've learned how to be more compassionate to myself. I've learned how to notice how bodies show up in the space just for myself. My eyes have been open to how much there is to learn and gain from being with my friends and family with chronic illness and disability. And so that's where it starts. And I am definitely excited to see how we're going to continue to grow those ways of being in the world on into larger scales and larger conversations.
You know, on the flip side of all this, seems to be a reward punishment coin when it comes to communicating your experience. We wonder if we're complaining too much, and when we're honest about our lives, we fear being stigmatized and stereotyped. We might accidentally make others feel uncomfortable if we joke about our bodies and doctors, but the truth is we are 60%. More of us live with these realities than don't. And of course, the 60% you're referring to there is 60% of adults in the U.S. dealing with chronic illness. What are you trying to convey here?
Yeah, talking to my friends with chronic illness and actually with mental illness as well, which would, you know, skyrocket that 60% to an even wider majority. I think there, as much as we can proclaim on Instagram or wherever that these things aren't or shouldn't be stigmatized, there's such a wide gap between that space and our lived experience and the cultures and systems we've grown up in, that it does remain very hard to even disclose the reality of a diagnosis at all, or an experience that's not been diagnosed yet. It's not that's not anyone's fault, right? Like, it is uncomfortable to talk about suffering, and we are also, in addition, like, not very well equipped to be in those spaces well with each other, I think. So when you talk about a reward punishment, there's like these expectations now, I think, especially in sort of progressive circles, like, that we hope to be more vulnerable with each other, and we hope to learn how to sit in those vulnerable spaces together, and we hope to include and accommodate people with various disabilities or illnesses, and we hope to honor experiences of suffering and of marginalization. And then there's also just the reality of, like, here we are in church on Sunday morning and someone asked me how I'm doing, or why I wasn't there last week. And there's just a choice to be made, and it's going to be uncomfortable either way. Like, I'm going to brush it off because I don't have the energy for the conversation. Or I'm going to go ahead and say, well, you know, I was totally fatigued and I spent the whole Sunday just laying on the couch wishing I could be here. And it sort of, you know, that does make a demand on the person you're talking to. And that is a vulnerable space to be in. And I think it's really worth contemplating and really worth practicing. I think practicing in whatever awkward ways we can, having these conversations, because we want church to be the place where we can have those conversations. And for our friendships or our relationships of solidarity and mutual aid, I think we all want to be able to be honest. I think we all want to be allowed to suffer. I think we all want to be the kinds of people who allow others to have their experiences of suffering with compassion and dignity. But we also want there to be a shortcut to that. And there's not a shortcut. There's just like this awkward moment and this experience of care that is unfamiliar or inconvenient. And that's the way we get there. The only way to that place of compassion and dignity is through like our bodily, messy, confusing, uncomfortable realities.
This book isn't just about physical health, but other empires, as you've called them. Kind of help frame that for our audience, what you mean by that.
Well, the book starts and the title starts with my body, where, you know, I over time I realized that as much as I spoke a language of social justice, I also was trying to make an empire of my life. That I had grown up again in the Atlanta suburbs and as a white, upwardly mobile, successful, conventionally labeled intelligent young woman. And what you do in that, in the life I grew up with, is you make things that are bigger and better, and you take your resources and you marshal them appropriately and you create something of yourself, right? And chronic illness not only cut off my ability to do that, but also showed me the ways that how I'd been taught to go about building such a lie was actually destructive to me and to lots of people and places and systems around me and in the end. And it also further, as I started to realize what it takes to heal in this sort of imperfect ongoing way that I talk about healing, what it takes is not revolutionary. It's not technological necessarily. It's paying attention to our humanness. It's getting enough sleep. It's being, for me, it's being aware of where my food comes from and paying attention to how it affects my body. And it is being around people who make me feel safe and who make me feel like a contributing community member. And all of these things work together to allow my particular body and my immune system, even more particularly, to operate at its best. And of course that facilitates my life being able to go on. And so as I started to understand what was preventing me from doing some of these basic things that we, our bodies and our souls need as humans. I had to, even my theological education had taught me to pay attention to the context of things, and I saw how many barriers we put in each other's way of being connected to these systems in just ways. And so I, trying to access nutritious food, is, there's so many barriers to that because our empires are not set up to encourage us our environmental stewardship and sustainability. We struggle to sleep and to rest and to connect with each other because we are so caught up in systems of capitalism that we didn't create and we don't intentionally maintain, but that also ultimately dehumanize us by using us as resources and not allowing us to live as full, again, like messy, embodied, and complex people. And so my illness also became a metaphor for what it means to be part of all these systems around us that, again, that we can't control, but we have to participate in them. We play a role in choosing what they will become, but we also have to learn to dance with them and work with them. And that really shifted how I understood what it means to do justice and to follow Jesus ultimately in this world.
We are pausing to tell you about one of our collaborative annual sponsors, a model ministry. Are you a church leader who's committed to keeping children safe? If so, then a model ministry is for you. We are a registered nonprofit organization specializing in safety education, policy writing, and risk assessment to mitigate child abuse in ministry organizations. We understand that child safety is a top priority for churches, and we are here to create a safe and nurturing environment for all children. Our founders can provide the resources and support needed to implement effective child safety policies and procedures. Visit amodelministry.com to learn more about our services and how we can help keep children safe.
Since 2016, CBF has brought you episodes of interviews with authors and practitioners for conversations that matter. These stories of creativity and innovation have garnered weekly support from around the United States and the world. We are inviting you, the listeners, to join us in connecting with the podcast. Become a monthly listener supporter and receive some perks, including name recognition on the podcast, questions for upcoming guests, free books from the podcast, joining the podcast for an interview, and a VIP experience with the General Assembly podcast guest. There are 5 levels of listener support, starting at $5 per month. For less than the cost of a pumpkin spice latte, you will be featured by name on the weekly podcast episode. For more information and to join the community of listener supporters, visit cbf.net/podcast support.
You know, one of the empires you write a great deal about is healthcare system. America's healthcare system is more tyrannical than capitalistic, you know, in the fact that costs are astronomical, the people dealing with medical debt, you know, that's an unfathomable number of people, leading many people to avoid care or not trust the system altogether. You know, we're not here to fix the healthcare system in this interview, but we can talk about why this is a theological matter.
Well, first of all, because Christians believe in the incarnation of Jesus Christ, and that means that bodies matter. And of course, we believe in the healing ministry of Jesus Christ. And we have sometimes a complex task ahead of us in understanding exactly what that means. But ultimately, it means that Jesus cares deeply for our well-being in all the interrelated ways that we are human, from the spiritual to the relational to the physical and emotional. And so in that sense, it's like a simply just a justice issue. It's a what it means to be human issue. It's also I think the healthcare system itself gives us a really interesting opportunity to reflect on how these things are interrelated. Where and to reflect on what healing means in a Christian sense. And when I walked into my doctor's office at 26 and asking for a miracle pill, that is Empire's go-to solution, right? Like, if we just work hard enough, we'll find the technology that will make our problem go away, and we won't have to deal with the underlying roots of it, right? And instead, I had to learn to heal on all these dimensions and within all of these systems. And I think that's the theological aspect that also really intrigues me, is how do we, when we talk about this like really daunting task of making the system more just, how are we also allowing it to be more than just like who's going to pay for the technology, but also how do we value caregiving and caretaking? How do we incorporate community well-being and public health into our understanding of what it means to be a more healthy and just place? How can our spirituality inform our self-care and our physical day-to-day choices? And how do we make those choices together in a different way than we have before? There's so much there. I don't want to go on and on and on forever, but also, how do we understand people's suffering, and how do we, you know, so many of that 60% of chronically ill adults in the US are people in poverty or people in racial minorities, and what are the underlying attitudes that are keeping us from addressing these like compounding systemic issues that are contributing to this problem? And is there something we are failing to understand about suffering that makes this so much that much harder to address as a enormous giant collective? And how could our spirituality and our theology be shifting those conversations as well?
You know, for many Americans, we've become detached from the problems of the world by believing that it's an issue for other places, other governments, other cultures. You frame the invitation to American cultural introspection as the, you know, examining as the Pax Americana. Walk us through what you mean by that.
Well, and so I didn't actually talk about the literal definition of empire, which would be a centralized government a centralized state with ever expanding aspirations that ultimately has to violently take over other territories in order to continue that expansion and in order to colonize them and extract resources to send back to the central place and people of power. So that's how I conceptualize empire. I always think about Rome, of course, as this thing that was a colonizer of so many areas of the Middle and Near East, and of course was such a huge factor in Jesus' life and ministry, and also that ultimately has to collapse because it's not a sustainable structure, right? To just be forever expanding outward and sucking resources into the center. That's like not actually how the world works. It's not a sustainable model for doing anything, even though we just as humans seem really compelled to forever constantly try to make it work. It doesn't. And so the US, when we're really frank about it, has also operated on this model all the way since the first time we crossed the Appalachians, times that we, our ancestors, colonized indigenous territories in the 13 colonies well before we were a state. And so since then, we've continued this pattern. We have annexed more and more territory. And while we have not annexed territory officially since the early 20th century, we have been able to use our economic and cultural power to gain power and control over lots of places and situations that are not ours to control. And so I think this is important, not just because we should not be violently colonizing places, but also because when we define prosperity, I think we're tempted to understand prosperity or flourishing or even justice in a lot of situations as modeled after these central forces, these colonizing forces, the people in power, the people with wealth. And once we start to understand that we are have been discipled by an empire towards the empire's purposes, not always necessarily intentionally by evil actors, but by the systems themselves, we start to also be able to question what flourishing looks like, what prosperity really means, and ultimately, of course, what peace means, because there is an absence of conflict when you have one world superpower, right? That was the promise of the Pax Romana, and that is the continues to be the argument for our insane military expenses and outlays. But are there more definitions of peace? Are there more beautiful ways of understanding peace and how we grow something like vibrant and something dynamic that is also a form of peace together, even if it's not enforced by the subtle threat of violence? How can there be a peace that looks totally different from this totalizing way that we currently understand it?
Let's take a break to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work. What is social work? At Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work, it's empowerment, service, and justice. It's ministry, counseling, and relationship building. It's faith, practice, and community. But above all, it's learning how to help others thrive. Social workers can be found addressing the full scope of the human experience in churches, schools, prisons, government agencies, senior living centers, nonprofits, and Fortune 500 companies. Careers in social work profession are vast and varied. What is social work, you ask? It's much more than you think. Visit gsswstories.baylor.edu to explore more.
As a person who's experienced chronic illness, you have a different relationship with your body than most. You write about fixing your broken body, by repairing your relationship with it. the complexity of our bodies is fascinating, you know, physiologically, let alone psychologically and spiritually. What do you think most people, do you think most people have a harmonious relationship with their bodies? And if not, why do you think that is?
Well, this is a great follow-up to your piece question, right? Or Pax America, my piece monologue, because we think we are at peace with our bodies when our bodies are doing what we want them to do. or our minds. And then when that is no longer our reality, we have a choice. We can say, is my body is against me, my body hates me. I hear this so often. And I won't say that I never ever say it myself. my body hates me, my body is against me, my body doesn't want me to live my life. Or we can say, my body is not doing what I hoped it would do, and maybe there's something underneath that. Just in the same way that if your kid or your niece or nephew or is acting out, you can say, this is a bad kid, or you can say, this child has a need that they're trying to express. And our bodies signal to us sometimes in beautiful, wonderful ways, and sometimes in ways that are inconvenient or painful. And I think most of us have a relationship with our body that has just been so conditioned by this need for control and this need for to use our body as a resource, that even those are often those of us who seem most at peace with our bodies are actually not actually in relationship with them at all. when everything seems to be going good, we can ignore our physical selves or work only to control our physical selves, like, you know, get a bikini body and, you know, live up to that all that societal expectation. But we're not actually participating in our life with our body. We're not letting our bodies be the partners in our life and even in vocation that I think they are made to be. From what I, you know, started this conversation talking about incarnation and creation. To me, these bodies are such incredible gifts. And I have, every time I, in my own experience, every time I start with the assumption that my body is a gift and its signals are a gift and that it is on my side and that God loves it and God made it this way for a reason, there, every time I start, sometimes just on faith in that assumption, there something is revealed to me that I never would have known otherwise. And a new way of being in the world opens up to me that, you know, magazines and TV and your boss are not going to offer.
You know, healing is a challenging term. You know, we see miraculous healings in the Gospels only leading people to have, you know, the same earnest faith without transformational healing. So when you talk about healing, what do you mean, and what kind of healing do you believe is possible?
If I could witness one outcome from this book, I think it would be that our understanding of healing changes from, I mentioned very briefly before, from an understanding of controlling our bodies or our minds, or controlling each other, when we talk about healing the world, when we talk about doing justice, often we mean well by trying to fix each other. And actually, we are called to be in right relationship. And that requires just a total different orientation to what this process looks like and what the outcome is going to be. And so I have been, you know, blessed and lucky and privileged, perhaps most of all, enough to come to a place with my chronic illness where we live in a dance. Where there's a lot of, I think, a lot of mutual respect between me and my body, where there's a sense that if I, at least at this point in my life, if I can listen to my body's signals and give my body what my body is asking for, then there's not going to be so much of a need to spiral out of control, right? And there's so many things around us right now and within us that feel or are spiraling out of control. And it's the most natural thing in the world to want to respond to that with clamping down and seizing control back from the thing. And again, throwing technology at the problem, throwing resources randomly at the problem. And actually what we're being asked to do is almost the opposite, is to let go and to pay attention and to ask with like deep compassion, what is this signal telling me? What is this unmet need here asking of me, or asking, or ultimately signaling that needs to change in the world? And I just, if we could shift our understanding of healing from that magic fix to encountering the world. I believe that Jesus's healings came from and contributed to the growth of his way of encountering people and encountering the world as whole beings and worthy of love and care, regardless of whether they, I don't think Jesus's healings existed to make people conform to societal norms and make people more palatable and comfortable to those around them, but they were ways in which Jesus met people in the dignity of their humanity as they were. And I believe that those healings also contributed to other healing around those people in tons of ways that is it Luke that says, if we tried to tell all the stories of Jesus and who he was, we would fill all the books in the world and we would never stop. I think so many of those stories are the ripple effects of what his healings and his interactions with people continued, how they continued to affect the people and places around them. And I think if we really committed to this understanding of healing, we actually would see some of these problems and illnesses that seem so intractable and empires, we would be just amazed at how quickly and creatively we found new ways of being.
Our guest is Lindsay Medford. The book is My Body and Other Crumbling Empires. You can stay connected with her by visiting lindsaymedford.com. Lindsay, it's been wonderful sitting down with you. Thank you for inviting us to see we are here to know the God who was wounded and the God who heals every day all over again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a really great conversation.
We are grateful for a chance to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Zondervan Media Group. Explore the depth and beauty of Scripture with the NRSV Updated Edition. With provisions based on new contextual evidence, historical insights, and linguistic precision, this updated edition of the NRSV delivers a translation of Scripture based on meticulous care for accuracy and readability. Learn more about new editions of the NRSV UE from Zondervan at nrsvuebible.com. Okay, that's it. That's our conversation. If you want more, be sure to subscribe to CBF on all major platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Google Podcast. Don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms. Be sure to support our annual sponsors by visiting their websites. Again, that's Gardner Webb University School of Divinity, a model ministry, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky, Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work, and Zondervan Media Company. Check out more at cbf.net for more information about church starters, field personnel, advocacy work, and more. And I'm not sure if we mentioned that you should join the listener support community at cbf.net/podcast support.